Okay, so recap of last time, we were talking about, or we started talking about synchronization. We defined what is synchronization, what is mutual exclusion. Mutual exclusion is basically a function that allows you to exclude some other threads from doing a task when a certain thread is working on something. A critical section, it's a piece of code that if that one and only one thread can execute at any given time. Okay, if some thread is executing, all other threads are blocked from executing that piece of code. We motivated this problem of why we need synchronization by looking at this real world example of too much milk. This is the task. This is a task where you and your roommate coordinate to ensure there is enough milk in the refrigerator. Okay, we looked at the first primitive to implement synchronization, which is lock. Okay, lock has two methods: an acquire method that you always acquire the lock before entering a critical section, and a release method. Okay, so those are the things that we sort of reviewed last time. We also saw that 0 is not equal to 1. Okay, some of you are totally zoned out at the end of the class, didn't really follow what I was saying. Okay, so try to follow what I'm saying. Today is a much better day weather-wise. This room gets really hot. I don't think I can teach here anymore beyond this class. But today seems to be better. So I will do a little bit of recap based on that minute paper that you wrote and provided some feedback. Okay, the interrupt part of semaphores was not clear. I'm going to review that in just a moment. I'll encourage you to ask more questions if at all things are not clear. Okay, try to follow, because as I was saying, this material will directly relate to what you do for the first programming assignment. So if something is not clear, it's better to ask rather than ignore and then struggle later. Okay, I have pre-Halloween candy here. If you want to ask questions, you take one when you go out. Can take one anyway if you want, but there is some here that I brought with me. Anyway, so let me start with just doing recap on hardware support. Okay, the thing that was confusing to many people was this notion of masking interrupts for implementing semaphores. Okay, basically I said how you can implement semaphores using masking interrupts. So let me illustrate that with an example. Okay, it may not be clear what interrupts are still, which is why there is some confusion. Let's assume that's a CPU. Okay, let's assume there's a thread A that's currently running. Okay, so this thread A basically gets a time slot. Let's say 100 milliseconds. It gets to run for 100 milliseconds. At the end of that time slot, a timer goes off. The timer is essentially a hardware interrupt. What that does is it basically tells the hardware. The hardware basically tells the OS saying the time is up. Okay. So what basically that does, or for that matter, when any interrupt comes, okay, what that does is it basically takes whatever is executing on the CPU and puts it in the wait queue. Okay. So A basically goes here. Whenever any interrupt arrives, the kernel starts running here. The kernel then basically checks what interrupt came. There are interrupts are numbered, so you have different types of interrupts. So you basically check what interrupt was triggered, and then you basically say this is basically maybe disk finished IO. Interrupt 1 means disk finished IO. You go and ask the disk what happened, and you read that data and something. And once you're done servicing that interrupt, A can actually start execute, or you can pick something else to run. Okay? So whenever an interrupt comes, you take whatever is on the CPU, suspend it. You run the kernel looks at the interrupt, does something. So equivalent to exception handling in Java. Okay, you're doing this in the hardware level. Now what has this got to do with semaphores? The basic problem with synchronization is to ensure that when you are in any critical section, okay, then nothing can interrupt you. You don't want you to get switched out and something else to run, because that can cause correctness problem. This is what happened in all of the examples we looked at for too much milk. Okay. So what you will do when you basically are in a critical section, when you do, let's say, lock acquire in a lock, is that you will basically disable interrupt. Okay, basically, you will basically say At this point, even if an interrupt comes, don't stop, suspend me. I want to continue execution. Okay. So if any interrupt, so A will continue to run regardless of whether its time slot expires, regardless of whether some disk has finished IO, those will still raise interrupt, but interrupts are masked, which means that they are held back from being delivered. Okay. So then this, because you are in the midst of a critical section, you will continue to run until you do lock release, at which point you will re-enable this interrupt. At that point, if your time slot has expired or if there is any hardware interrupt has come in the meantime, it will get delivered and it's fair game to suspend execution of this thread, do something else. Right? That's a process of masking interrupts prevents a thread from getting bumped off from the CPU. Okay? And this is exactly how you will guarantee that you will execute the entire critical section without basically getting scheduled out. So it's all or nothing. And by masking interrupts, you guarantee the all part. So once you have masked it, you will get to run. Okay, yes, question.
Does that need to be done at the hardware level, or is there
a way
to do that?
So mask is, so question is, how do you mask interrupt? So there is an instruction to do that, privilege instruction. So once you execute that instruction, it tells the hardware, saying even if interrupts arrive, assume that they didn't, just hold them back. Okay, so you basically can mask and unmask by executing some instructions. There's some question here. Okay. Is that clear? What are interrupts and how this enables you to implement critical sections? So by doing this, you prevent anything that will basically get this thread from being bumped from the CPU. That way you can execute this entire critical section without anything interfering with you. Okay, so you get that all or nothing, and basically you get the all property. Okay? That is basically how locks are implemented using enabling or rather disabling interrupts or masking interrupts. Yes. Okay. So question is, what happens when you mask interrupts? Is there a queue that stores the interrupt? So this depends on the hardware. In certain hardware, when you mask interrupts, and if an interrupt actually comes when you have disabled it, the interrupt will be ignored. Which means when you re-enable it, it will as if it was missed completely. In certain other pieces of hardware, there is actually a queue which tracks which interrupts were raised while they were disabled, and when you re-enable them, they will raise them again. Essentially, they will deliver them. Okay? This depends on really the hardware. Okay? It's not a good idea to disable interrupts for long periods of time, because that interferes with the hardware functioning on your machine. Okay? Because so you only do this for short periods of time. Okay. So that's enabling and disabling interrupts. There's one other way to implement locks. We said there's this test and set instruction. This is a single assembly instruction that checks the value of a variable and sets it to 1. Okay, so you can use the lock variable can be implemented using test and set, where you check if the lock is free and grab the lock all in a single instruction. Okay, so this allows you to acquire the lock atomically and release that lock atomically. Okay, this is the other way of implementing lock. We'll come back to test and set a little while. Okay, the bad thing about the test and set was that it involved busy waiting, where you're just spinning for a lock, waiting, sitting in a loop, spinning for the lock, wasting CPU cycle. Okay, so that's a quick recap of last time. Today we are going to do a new synchronization primitive. Actually, we'll do two. We'll do semaphores, and if we have time, we are going to start talking about monitors. Okay, monitors are the thing that are built into Java, as you will see. Okay, so what are semaphores? So think of semaphores as a generalization of a lock. Okay. At some level, a semaphore can behave exactly the same as a lock, but they are a generalization, so if you use them in more other ways, you can do more things with semaphore than you could just do with a lock. Okay. So what is a semaphore? A semaphore is essentially a special kind of an integer variable. Okay. Just as you have any integer variable, let's say int I, so semaphore is an integer variable. Okay, but there are operations on the integer variable that allow you to do synchronization. Okay, so it has two special atomic operations. So this is an integer variable that you cannot directly manipulate. Okay, you manipulate its value using methods, and then those methods allow you to do synchronization, as we will just see. Okay, there are two kinds of semaphores. Okay, one is called a binary semaphore or a mutex semaphore. This is basically functionality wise, it's exactly the same as a lock. It has its identical what a lock is, can take the code that is using lock and replace it with binary semaphores, and it will do the same thing. Okay? So in this case, in case of binary semaphores, the reason it's called a binary semaphore is this integer variable only takes two values, 0 or 1. Okay? Just as lock has two values, free or available, I mean not free, free and use, in use. So those are the two values of the lock. Same is true of binary semaphores. Okay, also called a mutex semaphore. It has a value of 0 or 1. Okay? If the value is 1, that means the semaphore is free. It's the equivalent to saying the lock is free. If the value is 0, that says that the semaphore is in use. Okay, that means that you will get blocked from doing other things. So this is a binary semaphore. Okay? Counting semaphore generalizes this concept. In a counting semaphore, that semaphore can take value 0 through n. Okay? Binary semaphores takes value 0 and 1. So if when n equals 1, a counting semaphore becomes a binary semaphore. Okay? So in counting semaphores, you have basically n plus 1 values really. And this is useful when multiple units of a resource are available. Okay? So suppose that there is a bank of printers. Let's say there are 5 printers. The print jobs are coming to print servers, and the print server is just firing off print jobs on a printer. Okay? There are 5 printers, and basically you initialize, you can protect this bank of printers, because only one job can print at any time. Okay? You can't send another job while a job is printing. Can protect that with a counting semaphore. Okay? So first job goes, the semaphore decrements by one, saying one printer is in use. The second job comes in, another printer is not taken up, the semaphore is decremented, and so on. And when the semaphore value goes to 0, that basically says all of those resources are presently in use. So if any new print job comes, it must wait until one of the printers becomes available, one of the semaphore is released. Okay? So you can guard multiple instances of a resource using a counting semaphore. A binary semaphore essentially guards a single resource. It's a single critical section or a single data structure. Okay, counting semaphore can guard multiple instances of a resource. Okay, and we'll see there is another use of counting semaphores, which is to do intelligent scheduling, that we will also see in just a moment. Okay, so let's look at some examples. Okay, now first, what are the methods on a semaphore? Lock has two methods, acquire and release. Okay, semaphores also have two methods, wait and signal. Okay, wait, in a binary semaphore, a wait is equivalent to an acquire. Okay. A signal is equivalent to a release. Okay. So the code is very similar. In a lock, you do lock acquire, you put the critical section, and you do lock release. In a binary semaphore, you do semaphore dot wait. Okay. That basically says wait until the semaphore is available, do a critical section, and at the end you do a signal. Okay. That's how you use that semaphore. Okay. So what do wait and signal do? Wait essentially decrements the value of your semaphore. I said they are integer variables. There are only so many operations you can do on an integer variable. Here we allow you to increment or decrement by 1. Okay? Wait always decrements. Okay? And signal always increments the value of the variable. Okay? But they do more than just increment or decrement. So what wait does is it will always decrement, and if the value is 0, it will cause that thread to block. It means that the wait will not exit. If the value of the semaphore has reached 0. The value is non-zero. Let's say it was 5 and you do semaphore dot wait, you will just decrement to 4 and the wait will come out, which means you got one resource and you will continue into the critical section. Okay, so wait does two things. It will decrement the value. If the value is 0, or if it has gone negative as we will see, you will block. Okay? And signal will always just increment. Okay? And if there is any thread waiting for that semaphore because it was in wait, it will also wake it up. Okay, so you increment and you wake up. Okay, clear? What wait and signal do? Yes or no? Okay, so there are two things here, wait and semaphore. So wait says if the semaphore is free, it continues. If the semaphore is not free, that means that you will put the process on wait. Okay, and signal will unblock and also increment. Okay, so this is the same example. Okay, here, this was the too much milk example using locks. Okay, you said, grab a lock, check if there is milk. If there is no milk, go buy milk, release the lock. Okay? So this code here, the if statement is protected by a lock, which means that only one thread can do that, execute those statements at any given time. Okay, if some thread has acquired the lock, all other threads have to block. That's what lock does. So essentially every thread executes the same code to implement this too much milk problem. Okay, this is that same implementation using semaphores. Okay, so you have to initialize the semaphore to 1, which means it is initially free, and then you see that there is a strong correlation. I said acquire is the same as wait, release is the same as signal. Okay, so same kind of thing works. Yes, question.
Where and when do you set the boundary of the semaphore? Whether it's binary or whether it has ends?
Okay. So question is, how do you initialize the value of the semaphore? Okay, so if you want to do pure synchronization, first you have to decide what are you using the semaphore for. Okay, so if you are just using it like a lock, all you do is you initialize it to 1 and you are done. And the semaphore behaves exactly the way as a lock. If you are actually doing more complex synchronization, and we will see examples of this more complex synchronization. One example I gave was the notion of this bank of printers that you are all protecting. Each request, print job comes in, it wants one printer. If one is free, you get it. If all of them are in use, you wait. In this case, you initialize it. Okay, when you declare the semaphore class, declare a new semaphore, in the constructor, you will initialize it to n, where n is the number of resources. Okay, so for now, you can ignore this. We are just going to look at this, and then we'll come back to this with an example, so it will be clear where you initialize it to n and why. Okay, so for just ignore that for now. Let's just look at this very simple case where it's behaving exactly the same as a lock. Any other questions? Okay. So this is basically too much milk example using semaphores. Okay, it's the same thing. You basically grab a semaphore. The semaphore is available. You enter the critical section. If it's already in use by some other thread, you will block here. Okay, until that thread is done and it does a signal. Okay, once you enter the critical section, you just check if there is milk. If there is no milk, you buy milk. Okay, and then you are done with your critical section. Okay, it's the same thing. Now the next thing we are going to look at is how do you implement the semaphore class. Okay, not this is how you use the semaphore class. Now we will see how the semaphore class is actually implemented. Okay. This is pseudocode at this point. Okay, so I have removed all the enable interrupt, disable interrupt, test and set and so on. We'll assume the same kinds of hardware functionalities available. This is only telling you at a high level what is happening in the semaphore class. And the signal and wait have to be atomic, which means they either use interrupts to get disabled at the beginning and enabled at the end, or you are going to use test and set to do these checks. Okay, that part is not shown here, but this high level pseudocode, this is as follows. Okay, semaphore class, two public methods, wait and signal. Okay, and then there is a value of the semaphore. Okay, that needs to be initialized. As I said, if you initialize it to 1, that means a counting semaphore, or rather a binary semaphore. You initialize it to n, it becomes counting. Same class works for either kind. There is no difference in implementation. And there is a queue. Okay? It's a queue of processes or threads that are waiting for the semaphore. A queue can be arbitrarily long. Any number of threads can compete for a lock or a semaphore. And only one gets it, everyone else has to wait, and they will be queued up in this queue. Okay? This is a constructor. So you basically initialize the value, you set the queue to empty whenever you declare a new semaphore. Okay, that's the wait process. Okay, as I said, wait always decrements the semaphore. So the first statement there is you're decrementing the value. Okay, always wait will decrement, signal will increment. Okay, so you decrement the semaphore and you say if the value has gone negative, that means the semaphore is basically currently in use. And at that point you have to block. That's what happens. You add the thread or the process to the queue and you block that thread. Okay? So you can think of how this works. Initially, let's say it's a lock or a binary semaphore, value will be 1. Okay? So when the first thread calls wait, you will basically decrement the value, so value is gone to 0. It is not yet negative. Okay, so you will not basically go into that if statement. The if statement says if the value is negative, then you block. Value is only zero, not negative, so you don't block. So you will just basically decrement it to zero and you will enter. Okay, the weight will exit, so you will enter the critical section. That's exactly what you want. Okay, the first thread has essentially grabbed that semaphore, brought the value to zero. Now if the second thread calls weight, you will decrement it again. Okay, so it will go from zero to minus one. Okay. Now if you check whether the value is less than zero, it is indeed. So you will go and block that thread, saying that some other thread holds the semaphore. This is why the value has gone negative. So you will block that thread until that thread calls signal and you will basically wake it up. Okay, that's basically how weight works. Signal is doing the opposite. Okay, it will always increment and it says if the value is less than or equal to zero, that indicates your queue is not empty. Because some semaphore decremented it further beyond zero, made the value negative and is now sitting on that queue. So you will basically just check this if that basically says queue is not empty. You will remove the first thread or the process from the queue and you will wake it up. Okay, that's the one that gets the semaphore next. Okay, this is basically how this code works.
So yes. Is this following the same pattern as guards with the block and wake up, or did guards work in a different way?
The guard was the test and set guard you're asking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So guard was basically, so this does not preclude the notion of a guard. These two functions still have to be executed atomically. So ideally in a real implementation you will either put a disable interrupt here and an enable interrupt there, or you'll put a guard statement at the beginning of both places.
Right. Well, so that there was some optimization that we had used with guard that was better so that it wouldn't keep spinning.
Yes. That was basically the yes. So that was doing the busy wait. If you use that same test and set thing, you would end up doing a busy wait. This is not doing that. I'm putting you to sleep.
Okay.
So you would actually have a guard at the both of the beginning of these two things, and then you are going to put them. So I have not shown test or set or interrupts. Those things were not shown here, but you would have to do exactly what you did in lock.
Okay.
Okay. So that part has not changed. But to avoid all the confusion, if you know how to use those interrupts or test and set, this is the higher level logic of what wait and signal do. Okay, so that's why it says wait and signal must be atomic, which means that you would need guard statements at the beginning of both. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so here is an example. Okay, of semaphore with two processes. Okay, here we are not actually doing any specific synchronization. What we have is a process P1, it calls wait twice and it calls signal twice, and your process P2, it calls a wait and a signal. Okay, and we'll assume that these processes are interleaved in arbitrary ways. So the question is, for a given interleaving, which is this, which P1 does wait and then maybe it gets context switch, then P2 does wait, gets context switch, then P1 does wait again and P2 does signal, what is going to happen? Okay, so what's the value after each of these statements? What's the state of the queue? Okay, so what's the value of the semaphore? What's the state of the queue? And are P1 and P2 executing or blocked at this point? Okay, for this sequence of statements. Is that clear? So all we are trying to figure out is if you were not doing synchronization, you just called wait and signal in some arbitrary order, what does this, how does the semaphore behave? Who gets blocked, who gets to run, etc. Okay, so initially, now this here you initialize the value to 2. It's a counting semaphore, not a binary semaphore. Binary semaphore you would initialize it to 1. Okay, so you basically, let's say P1 calls the first wait. Okay, essentially what you have to do is you have to execute that pseudo code and check what is going to happen. Okay, and these two things. Okay, so P1 is going to call a wait. Wait always decrements. Okay, the first thing wait will do is decrement. Value will go to 1. Okay, basically you are just executing that thing there. So wait went from value went from 2 to 1. You will check, is the value less than 0? No, it's not. So there is nothing. Q remains empty. Okay. So value is 1, Q remains empty, P1 gets to continue, it's not blocked. Okay? P2 hasn't done anything, so it's still executing. So here, this row is 1, empty, execute. Okay? P2 does a wait, next. Okay? So this is the order in which these statements are called. So P2 does the weight, value has gone from 1 to 0. Okay, 0 is not less than 0, it's not negative, the value is not negative, so you will not enter this if statement. So P2 also gets to enter the weight. Okay, so here value is 0, Q is still empty, P1 is executing, P2 is also executing, no one has blocked at this point. Okay, so then P1 calls the third weight. Okay, so at this point the value will go from 0 to minus 1. Okay, so first thing you have done is decrement, value has gone to minus 1, you will say is the value negative, at this point it is, if so then block this process or thread, so P1 is going to block. Okay, so the third row here, value has gone negative, minus 1, Q is no longer empty, P1 has been blocked and put on the Q. Okay, so the Q contains P1, P cap P1 is blocked now because it's sitting on the Q, P2 is still executing. Okay, so in the next statement, P2 comes and does a signal. P1 is blocked, it can't execute at this point. P2 has done a signal. Okay, so now you execute that signal code. It says increment the value. Okay, it was minus 1, it's now gone to 0. Okay, and it says is the value less than or equal to 0? Yes, it's 0, so this is true. So it will say go into this if statement, take the process that's at the head of the queue, which is P1, and wake it up. Okay, so what will happen here is the value has gone from minus 1 back to 0, you incremented it now, Q has again become empty, okay, because you took that process out of the Q and you woke it up, so now P1 is executing again, P2 is still executing. Okay, so now there are two more signals here. Okay, so P1 is going to do the next signal. Oops. So this will further increment the value. At this point the Q is empty, so there's no if, nothing is going to happen to the if statement. So the only thing that happens is the value goes from 0 to 1, Q remains empty, both execute. Value goes from 1 to 2, Q remains empty, both continue execute. Okay, so this is what's going to happen when you call wait and signal in that order. Okay, this is just for you to understand how the semaphore works, at what point something gets blocked, how it gets woken up again as a result of signal and so on. Is that clear? Any questions on this? Yes.
I P1 and P2 are in the queue, and so one of them calls signal, and which is the wake-up?
Okay. Question is, if P1 and P2 are both in the queue, if one of them calls signal, which one will be woken up? Okay. First of all, if P1 and P2 are both in the queue, both are blocked. If both are blocked, that means they will not run on the CPU. They will wait. Something else has to call signal. If there is a P3 somewhere and it calls signal, then they will be woken up. P1 and P2, if they are blocked, they cannot continue execution. So neither of them can actually go to their next statement and call signal. So that is the first thing to keep in mind. The only way this scenario you mentioned works is if there is a P3, where P1 and P2 is blocked, then you basically do a signal, then you are asking which of those processes to wake up. Okay? So here, we didn't actually say which process to remove from the queue. This is a policy decision, specific implementation specific. So if your queue is, you want to be fair, you wake up the process that's at the head of the queue. It's first come, first serve. Because if you entered in a certain order, you do FCFS and take them out in that order. Okay? But that need not be the case. That's really implementation dependent. A fair implementation would just wake them up in the order in which they went to sleep. Okay? The one that slept first gets woken up first. That's the way. So there, if P1 is at the head, you will wake P1, for instance. Okay? So the point that you should keep in mind is when you write code, synchronization code, you cannot make any assumptions about which order they will wake up. Because the implementation of a semaphore will not specify that it is FCFS or any. The code should work regardless of which order you wake up. And we'll see that that's how you need to write correct code. We'll see examples of that. Okay, in just one moment. Okay, so another example here, I'm not going to go through it. You can work through the same thing and figure out. Okay? But what I'll now show you is why I said semaphores are a generalization of locks. Okay, they do what locks do, but they can do more. Okay? And here is basically the two cases where you can actually do more. Okay? Okay, so first one is, I said, locks protect one resource. Semaphores can protect n resources. By using a counting semaphores, can protect n instances of a resource and do mutual exclusion. That's one thing. The other more interesting thing is you can actually specify scheduling constraints using semaphores. You can decide which thread to put to sleep and which thread to wake up using semaphores, okay, by calling wait and signal in a certain order. Okay? If you want to do this, okay, what you need to do now is actually initialize the semaphore to zero, not 1 or n, but you initialize it to 0. Okay? So if you initialize a semaphore to 0, the first time you call a wait, what is going to happen? Okay, suppose you initialize it to 0, the first thread that calls wait will basically execute that code. Because the value is 0, you just decrement the value, it becomes negative. Okay? And then immediately you basically are put to sleep, because the value has gone to 0. The value has gone negative. Is that clear? So if you want to put a thread to sleep within a synchronization problem, and we'll see a real problem in just a couple of slides, then what you basically do is just set S to 0, not 1, and then if you do S dot wait, this immediately puts the thread dot that called S dot wait to sleep. Okay? If it is non-zero, if it was 1, this wait would just decrement it to 0 and it will continue execution, it will not get blocked. But one easy way to block a thread, okay, if you want to block a thread for any reason, is to actually set the semaphore value to 0 and call wait right after this. Okay. That will put it to sleep. And then some other thread has to explicitly call signal to wake it up. Okay. So you can share a semaphore between two threads. One calls wait and goes to sleep. Another calls signal and actually wakes it up. Okay. So you can decide when to put a thread to sleep and when to wake it up using a semaphore. Okay? This you will probably do in your lab. Okay? So we'll look at an example of how to do this. Okay? So this is how you will do scheduling. Okay? This is user-specified scheduling. I decide it's time to put this thread to sleep, or this is the time to wake it up. Okay? So here is an example. We'll go back to our producers and consumers. Okay? If you remember, maybe 3 classes back, we said there is this abstract problem called producers and consumers. There is a shared buffer. Producers produce data items, they fill the buffer. Consumers consume data items from this buffer. Okay? If this is a bounded buffer, it can hold up to n items. Okay? So producer cannot produce more than n. If the buffer has filled up and the producer wants to produce, it's blocked. Okay? Similarly, if the buffer is empty, the consumer cannot consume, there is nothing to consume. So the consumer has to block until some data item is produced. Okay? So now we are going to do the most general form of producers and consumers, which is arbitrary number of producers, arbitrary number of consumers. We looked at one producer, one consumer earlier. Okay? Now we are going to do m consumers and n producers, okay? Arbitrary number. They don't even have to be equal. Okay. We'll also assume bounded buffer. That means the buffer is not infinite, it's limited to some value. It could be 10, it could be 100, doesn't matter what it is, it's some value. Okay. So what are the properties we want? Okay. Whenever a producer runs and it produces a data item, if this buffer has an empty slot, it should be able to immediately deposit that item in that slot and continue. Okay. So producer produces something, there is space to hold it in the buffer, just put it at some empty slot and continue execution. Okay? If a producer produces a data item and all slots are taken up, okay, then it has to wait. It has to be put to sleep until a consumer actually comes and picks one data item and frees up a slot. At that point it can go deposit that item. Okay? Properties for the consumer are the exact opposite. Consumer wants to consume, first you have to see, is there a data item that is sitting in this buffer. If there are none, meaning that the buffer is completely empty, then the consumer has to wait, there is nothing to consume. Okay? But if there is some data item, it needs to be able to consume it immediately and not block. Okay? So consumer blocks when buffer is empty. Producer blocks when buffer is full. Okay? When it is neither completely empty nor completely full, which means that some slots are taken up but some are free, producers can produce without blocking, consumers can consume without blocking. These are the properties we want. Okay? And on top of all this, the shared buffer is a data structure that's shared by multiple threads, which means that if any producer or any consumer is presently accessing this buffer, no one else can access it until it's done. A shared data structure means only one thread, regardless of whether it's a producer or consumer, can produce or consume at any given time, just access that buffer, meaning that you have to protect it with a lock. Is that clear what the problem is? Okay, we are going to solve this problem with semaphores. The problem should be clear what it is. Okay, this is your bounded buffer pseudocode. Okay, doesn't matter whether it's Java or C, it's just pseudocode, so it doesn't. So there are two public methods, producer and consumer. Okay, the producer clearly calls the producer method and it will deposit something into the buffer. A consumer will call the consume method. Okay, those are the public methods. There is your shared buffer itself. It's, think of it as an array of size n. Okay, so there are only n slots, whatever that is, you initialize it to n. Okay, and we will use three semaphores here, not one but three different semaphores. Each has a different purpose. Okay, so it's important to follow what we are doing. Okay, this is not a trivial problem. Once you understand what each is doing, then it becomes simple. Okay, we'll use one semaphore as a lock. Okay, that's called a mutex semaphore. So these are the names of the three semaphores. One semaphore is called mutex, one is called empty, one is called full. Okay, one semaphore, the mutex semaphore, is just acting as a lock. It is just going to guard your buffer, ensure that only one producer or one consumer can access this array at any given time. If something is accessing it, no one else can access it. Okay, that is your mutual exclusion. Okay, so one semaphore does mutex. Okay, the empty and the full semaphore are checking for conditions. Okay, as the name suggests, the empty semaphore basically checks how many slots are empty. Okay, count of free slots. The full semaphore checks how many slots are full. Okay, so they are actually checking how many slots are empty and how many slots are full. You need to keep track of this to prevent consumers from consuming when nothing is available, or producers from producing when all slots are full. Because you track how many slots are empty. Clearly the sum of empty plus full should be the size of the buffer. Okay, this is saying 3 slots are empty and 7 slots are full. That means there are 10 slots in the buffer. Okay? Is that clear? Yes or no? Anything that can clarify here? We haven't even started the solution. You're just sort of laying down preliminaries here. Okay. This is how you initialize the variables. The mutex goes to 1. Okay, that's a lock, so you'll always initialize it to 1. Initially, how, if you have a buffer of size n, how many slots are empty? All n are empty. Size n. The buffer has size n, so initially the buffer is empty, so all slots are empty. Okay? So size, so you initialize empty to n. Okay? The number of full slots is 0. Nothing has been produced, so you initialize full to 0. Okay? So you will see that these two, this is a binary semaphore, this is a counting semaphore, this is a semaphore that's initialized to 0. Okay? And it will do something interesting, as we'll just see in a moment. Okay? So that's the code for the producer. Okay? What does the producer do? It decrements empty. Okay? Weight will always decrement. So you decrement empty. The number of empty slots has gone to 0, then you have to block. That means there are no empty slots. So you will basically block. Initially all n slots are available. Okay? So first time you call weight, it just goes to n minus 1. That means you just picked one slot, but there's still n minus 1 available. There is no reason to block. Okay, there are plenty of empty slots, so you can go on producing. Okay? So you basically decrement empty. Okay? And then basically if you come out of that and you grab the lock, which is your mutex semaphore, you add the item to the buffer, you release the lock, which is you release the mutex semaphore by calling signal, and then you increment full. Okay? Full goes from 0 to 1. Okay? Basically it says I produced one item. So initially you say I took one slot, I added that item to the buffer, and then you increment full saying I have just added one item to the buffer. Producers can do this. The producer can do this up to n times even if the consumer is not running, because you can produce n items until the buffer fills up. Okay, so you can call producer once, it will just go through, not block at all. You can call producer another time, it will go through, not block, and so on. After n items have been produced, okay, your empty would have gotten decremented. If you call wait n times, empty will go to zero. Okay, if the consumer hasn't yet run, empty will actually decrement all the way to zero. The producer function is called the n plus first time, and if the consumer hasn't run thus far, then when you call wait, this will become negative. This is the n minus 1th decrement of this variable. So it goes negative, that causes the producer to block. Which is exactly what you want, which says if the buffer has filled up, if you are trying to produce one more data item, just make the producer block until the consumer consumes something, releases a slot. Is that clear? Yes or no? Okay. So if there is only one thread, let's say it ran n times through that loop and it produced n data items, n plus first time it's blocked on that empty. So it can't do anything at this point, it has to stop producing. Okay? At some point the consumer will run. Okay? Consumer will go, and what is it? The first thing it's doing is it's decrementing full. Okay? Full had gone from 0 to n. So what has happened is the empty. Empty here, this is full. Okay, so initial, let's just say 5. Okay, n equals 5. Okay, this is 0. Let's say producer ran, what does it do? It decrements this, it increments that. Okay, so buffer is all initially empty. All 5 slots are empty. At this point, one slot filled up. Okay, so it says one slot is full, 4 more are empty. Okay. The producer ran again. It's gone to 3, so into 2. Here 2 slots are filled up. Okay? So it's a producer ran. Okay, at this point, that's the order. All slots are filled up. The buffer is filled up. The producer runs again, this becomes minus 1 and is blocked. Okay, buffer is full, producer can't run. Okay. Now in this instance we are assuming consumer hasn't run yet. Okay, consumer could have actually run anywhere in between. Just in this simple example I'm assuming it didn't run. The producer ran very fast, filled the whole buffer up. So consumer run, okay, it's going to increment full. Okay. Or the decrement full, it's a wait. So this is going to go back to being 4. Okay, it will take the first element, it will consume an item. So your queue is going to look like that. That slot has gotten freed up. Okay, so it will get grab the mutex, it will remove the item, it will free it up, and now it's doing signal. Okay, signal is basically going to get this incremented. Okay, the code, go back to the code for signal. Okay, it's going to first its increment, the value is still 0. What it will basically look at the queue and wake something up on the queue. So what is on the queue? The producer is blocked sitting on the queue for that semaphore. So you will wake it up, so the producer is now woken up. Okay, so basically what the consumer has done is it has explicitly called signal and woken up the producer that was blocked. Is that clear? Okay. So this producer that was blocked is going to start running again. Okay. It will produce another data item, and here is a slot that it can put it in. Okay. It will go and deposit that data item here, and now the buffer has filled up again. Okay. Now it might be that the producer has woken up but is not yet scheduled for execution. Okay. So it's just waiting to run on the CPU, but it is no longer blocked. Okay. Once you call, the consumer calls the empty.signal, the producer is no longer blocked. Okay? So now maybe the consumer is still running, it is not done because producer. So this will increment to 1, that will go down to 3. You are basically 2 slots will free up and 3 will still be in use. Okay? And maybe at this point the producer that was blocked gets to run. It will basically decrement this back to 0, increment this to 4, and 4 of these slots will be filled up. Okay? So it doesn't matter in what order the producers and consumer run, this always works. Okay? Suppose that rather than having the producer start first, the consumer was the first thread to run. Producer hasn't even started running. Okay, what would have happened in that case? Okay, so you can go and look at the code. So producer will, rather the consumer will run and execute this code. Okay, what do you think will happen? Okay, consumer will be blocked, that's right. Why is that? Yes. So here is the case, this is your initial condition. Okay, if this was the consumer running first, okay, you will basically go and decrement way full. Okay, what's the value of full? It's 0. So this goes to -1. Okay, you're immediately blocked. Okay, so it is blocked. That's the right thing to do because there is nothing in the buffer. Buffer is still empty. So the consumer happens to run first, is automatically blocked, okay, by the way we have set up this problem. So it doesn't matter what order you run. Okay? If the buffer completely fills up, the producer automatically blocks. The buffer is all completely empty, the consumer is automatically blocked. Okay, if you are in this state where some slots are free and some are in use, neither of them is blocked. They just go and increment and decrement these variables, but both of them get to run and produce and consume without blocking. Okay? So the correctness of the solution doesn't depend on the order in which the CPU scheduler picks these threads for execution. Okay? It doesn't matter whether the producer thread runs first or the consumer thread runs first, the correctness conditions are always ensured. Okay? That's what you want your synchronization solution to do. It shouldn't depend on certain choice of ordering. Saying if you ran in this order, then the solution works, but if you change the order, then it breaks down. Okay. This is very important because when you do your first assignment, you will encounter something called a race condition. Okay. Race condition is a bug in synchronization code. A race condition basically says sometimes your program works and sometimes it doesn't. Okay. And the reason it works sometimes and it sometimes doesn't is it actually depends on a certain ordering of execution for it to work. If P ran first and C ran after that and P ran then everything is fine. Okay? But if the scheduler picks your threads in a different order, your basically code fails to work. Okay? And since you don't control the ordering in which the threads get chosen, you will see that you run the program, sometimes it runs beautifully. The result looks completely fine. So you think you are done. There's no bug in the code. But then you run it 2 or 3 times, once in a while it will get scheduled in some different order and your program produces garbage. Or it gets blocked. Nothing seems to happen. Okay? So whenever you have synchronization, keep this in mind. Debugging code that has synchronization is very hard. Okay? Because it's not like you can just fire up a debugger and figure out what went wrong. Okay? You have to wait until the scheduler picks the wrong order of execution to even reproduce the bug. When you are single threaded program, if you have a bug, it will always hit that bug and it will produce the same incorrect result. When you are multi-threaded program, sometimes your code will run, sometimes it will not run. When you run it through a debugger, then you may not even be able to reproduce that problem. Okay? So the short, long story short, don't just run your program with one test case once and it produce correct result and submit it and go home. Okay? There may still be, you may still be writing incorrect code. You have to test it number of times with number of different inputs and make sure it always runs. For all reason, like we did here, that no matter what happens, your code will actually be correct. Okay? This is a big problem with any multi-threaded synchronization code. Okay? Debugging this code is not trivial. Okay? I can pretty much guarantee that you will immediately run into this problem. If you haven't used synchronization primitives before, because if you don't put the weight and the signals in the right place and reason about it, that means that your code will definitely have some problem or the other, and it will get, it will show up at one point or the other. May not always show up. Sometimes your code is so wrong that it will never work. Those bugs are easy to spot. Right? But if you have race conditions, those are very hard to spot. Yeah, they may occur once in very few, once in million executions. Yeah, so that's something to keep in mind. Okay? Alright, so this is just showing you pictorially all the stuff I did on the board. So I'm going to skip all this. And since we still have a little bit of time, I'm going to show you another synchronization primitives which solves this problem, okay, of race conditions and all this complicated stuff, or where to put weight and where to put signal, and then you have like pages and pages trying to reason whether your code works or not. Okay? So the next synchronization primitive is called monitors. Okay, there's another concept with monitors called condition variables that I'll also introduce in just a moment. Okay? So semaphores at least allow you to do synchronization. Okay? So you have multi-threaded code, you can get it to do certain things. Okay? Have the threads cooperate on a task, ensure that they will never violate safety conditions, do bad things, etc., etc. Okay? But the problem with semaphores is that they are too low level of primitive. Okay? You have to reason about where to put the weight. How many semaphores do you need? Where to put the signal? Okay, in what order to do this and understand why it is going to work and so on. Okay? So reasoning about the correctness of the code is much harder. It's almost like semaphores are the equivalent of programming at the assembly level from a synchronization perspective. Okay, so you are at that level, we are doing very low level synchronization and trying to understand what's going on. So what you want is basically higher level primitive that makes it very easy to figure out that this code is going to behave in this fashion. I don't need to think about it twice. Okay, and you still want to solve certain problems. Okay, so now we are going to raise the level of synchronization programming and doing synchronization one level up. Okay, with a higher level primitive called monitors. Okay, the other thing with semaphores, as I said, is there is no guarantee of proper usage. It's very easy to make mistakes. You put weight and signal in the opposite order, you basically introduce bugs in your program. Okay, so usage is hard because the primitive is at a lower level. Okay, so let's now talk about this next primitive. It's called a monitor. So what is a monitor? Monitor is a class or an object, okay, with one special property. So you can take any arbitrary class. If you've done Java programming, which I presume all of you have, think of a monitor as any class that you have ever written, but with one extra property. Okay? That one extra property is that you can take all the data, all the variables in your class, all the methods in your class, and add synchronization support to it in a very simple way without doing anything complex. Okay? So monitors, unlike classes, okay, monitors will guarantee mutual exclusion. Which means that if you make any class, it's trivial to take any Java class and turn it into a monitor, as we'll just see. Okay? By doing that, what you guarantee is in only one thread will be able to call any method of this class at any given time. It's automatically guaranteed. If you have 10 methods in that class, as soon as you turn this class into a monitor, only one thread can call any method. If there's any thread in any of the method of this class or this object, then everything else will be blocked. Some other thread calls a method of this class, is blocked. Okay? So that's basically what it does. It guarantees mutual exclusion, which means that one thread may execute in the monitor at any given time. Okay? We'll see that monitor requires all data to be private because it's guarding those variables. You can't access it from outside the class. You can only access it from inside methods of the class. Okay? So here's a formal definition, and I'll show you now after this slide how to do this in Java. Okay. So a monitor basically has a built-in lock. Okay. You don't actually declare this lock explicitly, but think of it as soon as you say this class needs to be a monitor, internally a lock is declared. Okay. And every method of this class is now protected by this lock. Every data variable that belongs to this class is protected by this lock. So whenever any thread calls this method, it has to first internally grab a lock. If some thread already holds a lock and is executing a method, then any other thread that calls this method of this class or any other method of this class automatically blocked. Okay, so a monitor basically includes a lock and it has zero or more what are called condition variable. That's a concept that we haven't introduced, but we will hold off on that. Okay, condition variables allow you to order the access, concurrent access to shared data, put threads to sleep and so on. Okay, so the monitor uses the lock to ensure that only one thread can execute. Okay, it provides mutual exclusion, and condition variables allow a thread to go to sleep inside a critical section and release that lock. And when they wake up, there it's automatically guaranteed that they have reacquired the lock. Okay, so what you can do now is you can go to sleep inside a critical section while you're holding the lock and give this lock up. When you're woken up, the lock comes back to you. Okay, nice abstraction. Why do we need it? We don't know yet. Okay, so we'll come back to that in two slides. Okay, so we can do a variety of things. Okay, so we'll look at an example and it'll make it all clear. So here is a way by which you can take any class and you can make it a monitor. Okay, this is a Java class called a queue. Okay, all you do is you have to do follow two or three rules. Okay, the first rule is in this class all data objects should be private. Your variables, your data structures of any kind, nothing is public. Okay, all variables are private. Okay, without that you cannot turn it into a class. Okay, so if you follow that rule, then you are done. Okay, then the only thing you need is to add one keyword which is in front of every method of that class. You add the word synchronized. Okay, as soon as you do this, so you take all the methods. So this queue class has two methods, is add to the queue and remove from the queue. So only thing you have done is you added this word called synchronized. As soon as you do this, this class turns into a monitor. Okay. What synchronized tells your Java virtual machine is that this class is a monitor, internally declare a lock for this class. Okay. Guard access to this class using that lock. If some thread is called add, first make sure that thread acquires this lock. Okay. Only then it gets to continue. If the lock is in use, it will actually block. Okay. It will not even enter the add or the remove method. Okay. So only one thread can be in any of these methods at any given time. If some thread is in there, some other thread calls either one of these methods, they get blocked and until that thread exits. Okay, once some other thread exits, then some other thread gets to execute. Okay, this is all guaranteed for you. You don't need to do any of this. Okay, so there is no lock acquire that you write. There's no lock release. You don't even declare the lock. All you have basically said is this keyword synchronized, and your Java virtual machine, Java library does all of that synchronization for you. Okay, much higher level programming. Okay, just use keywords and you're done. Except for this condition variable, we'll come to that in a moment. Okay, so this is actually our bounded buffer, our producer consumer type problem. So what this does is you add an object to the queue. This remove says if the queue is not empty, remove that item and return that item. Okay, that's basically what this has done, and all we have done is made all the data structure, the queue, maybe a linked list or some such thing that is private, and then these two are public methods. You added this keyword synchronized. Okay, now we'll look at some other concepts here. So next thing is, what do we need this other thing called condition variable for? So if you go back to remove, you'll see that what remove has done is that it's checking if the queue is not empty. If so, you remove the item. Okay, so long as the queue is not empty, this remove works just fine. Now if the queue was empty, then remove is not going to return anything for you. Because if you call remove, it will basically just exit without it. There's nothing to remove from the queue. So now if you want a behavior which says that whenever you call remove, you want it to return a valid item, not just come out of it saying queue was empty, there's nothing to remove. If you want it to return a valid item, then you will want the thread that called remove to wait until the queue becomes non-empty. And then you want it, then it can take an item and remove it. Okay? So if the semantics of remove are remove will always return a valid item to you. Okay? So then if there is the queue is non-empty, that of satisfying that property is fine. You just take that one item and you return it. But if the queue was empty, then you have to make the thread that called remove wait until something actually adds an item to the queue. Otherwise you can't guarantee that you will always remove an item. Okay, is that clear? what I just said? We don't know how to do this yet, but all I'm saying is, if you want Q dot remove to always return a valid item, then what you will have to do is, if Q is empty, then you want it to sleep until the Q becomes empty. Okay, then you remove this item and return it. Okay, the question is, how do you do this? Okay, that's what is basically being done with condition variable. So it says, how can we change remove to wait until something is on the queue? Okay, so logically, you want to go to sleep inside the critical section. Okay, and then wait for the queue to be non-empty, and then you come back and remove that item. Okay, so now you might say, okay, that is trivial to do. I'm going to write the pseudocode. Okay, so here is pseudocode for remove. Okay, so this is synchronized. So this is all protected by lock. So you'll say, if Q is empty, okay, rather let's make it while. Okay. Okay, so all I've done is I've added a sleep condition in this remove. Okay, I basically check saying while the queue is empty, sleep for 5 seconds. You wake up after 5 seconds, you check again. Queue is still empty, go back to sleep. So every 5 seconds you wake up, you check if the queue is empty. The queue is empty, you go back to sleep until the queue becomes non-empty. At this point you go and you remove this item and you basically return it. Yeah, this is a trivial way by which I can guarantee that, not guarantee, but I'm trying to ensure that remove will always return a valid item, regardless of whether the queue is empty or not at the time remove was called. Okay, so what's wrong with that solution? Or is there something wrong with it? I mean, there's no reason to presuppose that there is anything wrong. What's wrong with checking every so often? It may be not 5 seconds, you can check every second, you can check every 100 seconds, doesn't matter. Yeah, check every so often, yes.
Well, if the queue never has something in it, it'll just keep looping.
Sorry, what do I say?
If the queue is always empty, nothing ever gets put in it, it'll just keep sleeping.
Yes. If the queue never becomes empty, there is nothing, you have to be stuck in there. That's what remove says. Remove says, if I return from remove, you have an item. If there is no item, I sit there forever until an item is produced. Those are the semantics. So if the queue is not empty, you will sit there. Absolutely true, but that's also right thing to do, because if you guaranteed somebody that if I come out of remove, I'll give you an item, and if there is no item, you sit there. Yes, something.
All the problem is it's sleeping, it's still going on the block and nothing else.
Right. So one problem is you go to sleep thinking that I will wait for some time, wake up and check if the queue is empty. But remember that if you are in synchronized, you are already holding the lock for this class. Okay? So you go to sleep for 5 seconds, wait, assuming that some other thread will go and call add, or whatever that thing is. Yeah, add. Okay? So if some other thread does call add while this thing is sleeping, it will first try to grab the lock. Okay? That's what synchronized does. You have to first get the lock before you are allowed to enter the thread. This thread that is sitting in here, gone to sleep, is already holding the lock. It went to sleep, but it's still in that it's still in a synchronized method, which means it's holding the lock. Okay? So anything that calls add is going to get blocked. It will not even be allowed to proceed. Okay? So this code is guaranteed to ensure that remove will never exit, because it is not allowing anything to enter the add method.
Semantically,
that's not what we want. Right. So semantically what you want is, if I go to sleep, I let some other thread make progress and actually add something so I can exit from remove. Right? So what you really want is sleep and release my lock temporarily. Yeah, I yield my lock, I give it to someone else so that good things can happen. Meaning somebody can go and enter this add such thing and add something to the queue. Okay? And when something gets added to the queue and I come out of this, I better have the lock back. Just because I yielded the lock, if I now come out of sleep and I don't have the lock, I'm in trouble. Because lock can be held by only one data item, one thread at any time. If I'm in a synchronized method, I need the lock. That's the semantics of synchronized. So what you want is some abstraction that allows you to sleep, give up your lock, but when I wake up, I'm guaranteed to have reacquired the locks. I yield the locks and take it away from me temporarily, but then if you wake me up, you better give it back to me, because I'm still in a synchronized method. So if I'm executing there, I better be guaranteed I hold the lock. Okay? That's exactly what condition variables do. Okay? So that statement that I just showed you here, okay, this thing which is not sleep and release lock, is what a condition variable will do for you automatically. You don't actually write that code, you just declare a condition variable and it does it all for you. Okay? So solution is condition variables allow a thread to sleep inside a critical section. Any lock held by the thread is automatically released when the thread is put to sleep. More importantly, when you wake up, the lock is given back to you. So it's as if nothing happened. You went to sleep, you wake up, lock is back, you continue execution. Okay, so then how do condition variables work? The methods on condition variables actually look identical to semaphores. Condition variables are not the same as semaphores, but the names of the methods just happen to be wait and signal. Okay, so just but keep that in mind that this is a wait on a condition variable. So when you do a wait on a condition variable, it atomically releases the lock and goes to sleep. Okay? And when you exit from wait, it's like I came out of sleep, I'm guaranteed that I've reacquired the lock. This is the function that the abstraction guarantees to you. So wait just said I'm going to go to sleep, take the lock away from me. When I come out of wait, which means I'm woken up, the lock is back in my hands. Okay? And signal basically says wake up. If some thread is sleeping on a condition variable, it is basically doing this. It has gone to sleep and yielded the lock. Wake it up and give it back the lock. Okay? So signal essentially wakes up a waiting thread if one exists. If there are nothing sleeping, it does nothing. Okay? Broadcast is equal to signal all. Signal will wake up one waiting thread. There may be 10 threads that have all gone to sleep inside synchronized methods. Signal will wake one of them up. Okay, it doesn't tell you which one, but it's guaranteed one of them wakes up. Okay. Broadcast will wake them all up. Okay, they all will wake up and only one of them will actually get the lock. Not all of them will. They will all compete and one of them will get the lock. And the others will actually have to go back to sleep. Okay, so here is our code. Okay, same code. Okay, synchronized is still here. This has not changed. Put the item on the queue. Just added a notify here. We'll see what that does. But here is your remove. It says while the queue is empty, wait. So now you have basically used the built-in condition variable. So with every monitor comes a built-in condition variable. Okay. So this is equivalent to saying this dot wait. Because as soon as you say synchronize, a lock is declared for you internally, and a condition variable is also declared for you internally. Okay. You can have more than one, but one is given to you by default. Okay. So you say while the queue is empty, you wait, okay, which says basically give up the lock, go to sleep. Okay? Whenever you add, you just say notify, saying if some thread has asleep, waiting to remove, wake it up. Okay? If no thread is asleep, the notify does nothing. Okay? That's what we said notify does. It says it wakes up a thread if there is, I guess this says there. Notify basically signals a condition that thread. And wait gives up the lock. Okay? In Java, okay, you'll see that there is some change. Wait is still called wait, but signal is called notify. Okay, so that's how Java implements it. The abstract notion of a condition variable uses the term signal. The Java implementation uses the term notify. Okay, notify and notify all. Okay, so this is what you do. Okay, it says why if queue empty, go to sleep. Whenever you put an item, you say do a notify. Just to be safe, if something is asleep, wake it up. Nothing is asleep, the notify does nothing, so no harm done. Okay, so now we have all the properties we want. Remove guarantee is that whenever it comes out, it will give you a data item. If there is the queue is empty, it will wait until a data item has been put on the queue. Okay, it's not going to do any busy wait, it's asleep, so no cycle, CPU cycles are wasted, and it has given up the lock, it's yielded it for the thread that will do add and so on. Okay. Any questions here? Yes.
So we just said wait and notify, which seems to be for all of the queues or anyone who might be calling the queue, but say that we've got more methods and we're modifying different private variables. Wouldn't we want to tie the wait and notify to one particular variable or
yes.
particular set?
So what you're saying is there may be multiple variables, data structures, and you may be checking different ones. So don't you need more than one condition variable? That's why I said, if you go back to the definition of monitor, it says this has a lock and it has zero or more condition variables. In Java, one is given to you by default. You can have more than one. You will have to, if you need more than one, then you declare additional ones. Okay, when in the constructor, you will say condition variable one, condition variable two, you will declare more than one. Then you will say condition variable one dot wait and condition variable one dot notify. So that notify will only wake up those threads that are doing wait on that condition variable. So that's why I said this is the default one. So you can say it's like this dot wait, which means it's the default. But you will have, you can certainly declare as many as you want and have them sleep for different things and have them explicitly woken up for those things only. Okay? So that part is not a problem. But here is the issue. Why do we need a while here? Okay? Why not put an if? Okay, why did we put a while? Why did we not just say if queue is empty, wait, something will eventually add an object to the queue, do a notify to me. So when I've woken up, I actually have the queue to be non-empty. Why do I need a while? Yes.
If someone had done something that didn't, well, for one example is if someone did something that notified but didn't notify about this particular queue variable, then we need to check. We'd also need to check if they did a notify all.
Okay, so forget notify all for now. Yes, okay. There's notify all we didn't even look at. That will wake up all threads. But why do we need it otherwise?
If we have several stacked removed, if we have several removed waiting, will it notify each of those?
Right. So the one thing that we haven't implicitly looked at is how many threads are actually sitting in remove and how many are doing that. So this, by using synchronize, you can have arbitrary number of threads in your application Java program and they should all work fine. So if there are, let's say, two threads that both called remove and the queue was empty, both would have actually slept. Okay? So when you call notify, or as was pointed out, if you actually even call notify all, multiple of them will be woken up. Okay? So you don't want, if both threads got woken up and if they came out, if this was a if, they would both go and try to grab that item. You can't do that. Okay, you can only let one of them grab the item and the queue becomes empty again. Okay. So because notify all can actually wake up multiple threads, you want to recheck the condition because some thread, the other thread that was woken up with you might have gone ahead and caused that condition to become true again, which means it may have gone and taken the only item out of the queue, so queue becomes empty again. Okay, so again, let me repeat what I just said. If there are two threads, both of them are in remove, they both find the queue to be empty, both are here, both are in wait, both have slept and given up their locks. Let's say your add thread comes along, it adds one item to the queue and it does notify all here rather than notify. This will wake up both of those threads that are in remove. Okay? One of them will grab the lock first. Both can't execute at the same time. Okay? Because lock can be held by only one of those threads. So let's say thread A is the one that is lucky to get the lock. So it comes here and it grabs the item and it exits. Okay? Now the queue has become empty again. But because notify all woke up both the threads, thread B has also been woken up. Okay? So as soon as A is done and it comes out of here, the lock becomes free, it's being given to B. Okay? B comes out of wait. If this was an if, it would come out of wait and try to remove an item. But the queue has become empty again because some other thread ran before you and grabbed that item before you. Okay? So you're better off doing a while and you actually go back and check saying, I was woken up saying that condition is no longer true, but an arbitrary amount of time may have elapsed since I woke up. Is the condition still true? Is there something else run in the meantime and make it false again? right? So you always do a while, and in this case you will actually see that A actually ran and made the queue empty, so you go back to sleep. Okay? So long story short, what you want is this code to run regardless of in what order you are woken up. Okay? You don't want to depend on the scheduler to do something and make you run in some order. Okay? So it's always better whenever you have a condition variable, you say while the condition I am waiting for is still true, go to sleep. Okay? And then you keep checking, and once it becomes false, then you know you hold the lock and the condition is false. At this point, nothing else can change that condition. Nobody else can make it go false because you hold the lock. Then you go take that item. Okay? So this is the recommended way of programming with condition variables. You sit in a while loop and check. Because just sitting in a if condition and checking might not be the right thing. If multiple threads are woken up, one just happens to run before you and does something and makes it go false again. Okay? So what we'll do is we'll stop here for today. So I'm going to continue. So the basics of what monitors are. There are some subtleties that I will discuss on Thursday. Yeah, but for today we are going to stop.
What is the library assignment for these times?